Amen. Come on in. There's some food in the back. Feel free to grab some coffee, and find a seat. So I have permission to tell the story. It's actually not about me, so that's good. I was talking to a guy this week, and I've been really pleased. I've gotten some really great feedback about the class, and I hope you've enjoyed it. We're coming down to the last couple of weeks. And a buddy of mine was in here a couple of weeks ago, and he has a Bible app, you know, like the Bible.org on his phone. And so he was taking notes, and there was one part that he was really inspired by, and it was talking about how, like, loving your wife, for guys, loving your wife so well that she says, "Take me to bed." Like, and she leads him in the song that we looked at. She says, "Come with me," and she drags him off to the bedroom. And so in sort of this fit of inspiration, he's taking notes on his phone, and he's like, "Man, this is how I want to love my wife. I want to love her so well that she says, 'Come with me and take me to bed.'" And a few minutes later, his wife said, "Honey, did you mean to post that publicly?" He told me, he said, "I didn't know how to erase it, so I started unfriending everyone I knew on the Bible app as quickly as possible." He said, "So I have no friends on the Bible app anymore. So I can figure out how to delete that, and then I'll do it again." So yeah, so we are talking about the Song of Songs. And you can, by the way, you can do that privately. I showed him how afterwards. I said, "Look, it's really simple, like this." And he was like, "Oh, good." Yeah, or you just write it down, right? Old-fashioned way. Yes, I know. All right, so throughout this series, we've been just sort of asking this question, why the Song of Songs? Why is this so important to us? And what we've said continually is that it's a reminder of in a sense, like how we fell in love to begin with and why we fell in love to begin with. And it's a celebration of romantic and passionate love, and it's an invitation to kindle, or in the case of those of us who've been married for a really long time, at times to rekindle that passion and that romance of relationships, those strong feelings of love and desire that in reality, like, you want to have for your spouse. And you know, the fact that you're here and you keep coming back each week is because this is the kind of marriage that you want to have. You know, I was thinking about it this week, and I thought, what would my newlywed self say to me if he was here and could see my marriage? You know, what would your newlywed self say? If you think back all those years, some of you wasn't that long ago, some of you it's been a while, but if you remember what that was like on your wedding day and those weeks that followed, like, what would they say? Would they be inspired? Or would they be depressed? Would they be a little worried about you? What would be their take on your marriage today? And I think the temptation is to say, "Well, we were so young and stupid back then." And that's true. And so we tend to sort of make excuses in a sense. And go, "We were so young and so stupid. We didn't know what life was really about. We didn't know everything that life was going to throw at us. We had no idea what it was going to be like to have kids and to suffer through a lot of hard things that a lot of us have been through over the years." You know, but something that I realize is that in doing that, that's actually not wisdom. So we think of that as maturity. "Oh, I've matured and I'm so much smarter and wiser," but that's not wisdom. See, wisdom is not resignation. Wisdom is not complacency. Wisdom is recognizing what matters most and then investing in it. And so don't think that you're so much wiser than yourself when you were younger. You maybe, I hope so. But see, wisdom doesn't say, "Well, I would love my wife that way. I would love my husband that way. I wish we had that kind of marriage," but that's unrealistic. Wisdom says, actually, this is worth investing in. Wisdom says this is a priority or should be a priority. And so if I'm too exhausted or life is too much that this doesn't get top billing, then I need to shift my priorities. That's wisdom. And so I don't know what your newlywed self would say. I would love to talk to Carrie. We haven't had this conversation. And think, what would our newlywed self say? But don't dismiss it too quickly. If you imagine that conversation, don't dismiss it too quickly. Maybe they have more wisdom to share with us than we think. So this morning, we're going to look at the sixth song. And this one, I think, has a theme. As I read through it and I was studying it, I think it has a theme that may be one of the most important, if not the most important theme of the whole series. Because what comes out of this song is this theme of one and only. That person that you are married to is your one and only. We're looking at a song that is about treasuring your spouse above everybody else. It's a song is about seeing them as where you find your greatest satisfaction and nowhere else. There's an exclusivity to the conversation. There's an exclusivity that is implicit in the song that we're going to look at. That husbands, we would see our wives as our precious one in whom we find our satisfaction and there's no one else. And then also that they would know that. That our wives would know that our husbands would know that. They would know that they are the one that we want and there's nobody else. How powerful that would be. Because here's the danger. Familiarity breeds contempt, or at least indifference. And we hate to say that. We hate to like imagine that, but we know it's true. You see the same thing over and over and over again, you're kind of like, yeah, seen it. You have the same experience over and over and over again, and yeah, you've experienced that. And we live in a society that worships cheap pleasure. And we live in a society that worships the next big thing. And the constant message is this: anything that gets in the way of your pleasure needs to be discarded. And its corollary is that life is about pleasure, that this is what we should be pursuing. And so it dangles, when we think about relationships, when we think about intimacy, it dangles this kind of cheap intimacy in front of us as bait and says, but here's something better. You've had that, try this. And so it's constantly calling us with this comparison and consumerism, and you need to try something new. The next big thing. And it's not enough. What you've experienced, what you have, that's old hat. And so it's calling us to this. That was not the picture that I wanted you to take, Don, when I'm doing this. This is not the.
Strike a pose.
Fire and brimstone. I know, right? That's exactly. All right. But here's the encouragement, and I think as we read through the song, remember, it's always an invitation. As we read through the song, what it's saying is, you want to love like this. You want to have this kind of a relationship, and if you see your spouse as your one and only, and they look back at you and say, you are my one and only, it will transform your marriage. Wherever you are, whether it's great, man, it'll be better. If it's on the rocks, it'll get better. When you say, you are the one that I want, and no one else, it's what everybody longs to hear. And it's interesting because we get scared to say it. It was scary leading up to your wedding. If you remember that, the first time you said, I love you, that's a huge leap of faith. I'm walking out on this cliff. I'm going to say this. Will she say it back? There's a vulnerability to this. But even as you've been married and there are hurts along the way and there are scars that you give each other, it can become scary to say that again. There's a vulnerability that we almost have to recapture and push through again and again and again to say again, even in the midst of hurt, in the midst of struggle within your marriage, I know all this is happening, but I want to be really clear. You are the one I want and no one else. All right, so let's read through this. This is a beautiful one. Let me just warn you real quick. This will be PG-13, okay? I know sometimes I've said that and it's been a little bit less than PG-13. This one, I'm feeling pretty strongly about this, okay? PG-13. Okay. So you are beautiful, my darling, as Tirzah. Tirzah was, it means pleasantness, and it was actually the name of a city in the northern part of Israel. And so it's a beautiful city. That's what he's saying. You are as beautiful as this city. It was a well-known city for its beauty. Lovely as Jerusalem. We might say you're as beautiful as Milan or beautiful as Paris. Lovely as, not Dallas. We'd never say that. Don't do that. Lovely as Jerusalem. Majestic as troops with banners. turn your eyes from me, they overwhelm me. So in poetry, you often have this this picture of the intensity of gaze, right? The intensity of looking someone in the eye. I mean, I remember when Carrie and I got married and we're standing up in front of everybody, and she's in her amazing, beautiful dress, and I'm in a really not great tuxedo. And you're making those vows, and you're looking at each other. And the intensity of that moment of, like, I am looking in your eyes, making these vows, you almost want to, like look away. But, of course, you can't. You don't want to. But there's an intensity to a gaze, and he's saying, look, like, you're looking at me in a way that I can hardly bear it. And there's this boldness that she has, this confidence, and it's almost intimidating to him, the way that she's staring at him. He's overwhelmed. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep coming up from the washing. Each has its twin. Not one of them is alone. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of a pomegranate. So we've had some of this language before. This is, you know, you need to adapt this contextually when you're complimenting your wife. I sent Carrie a text this week and said, your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Gilead. And it's funny, I really just got a laughing face back. It wasn't like, oh, thank you. She just laughed at me. So it's interesting, though, that the in these songs, he's actually repeating some of the language that's he's used before. You'll recognize some of this from earlier praise songs, praise poetry. And I think there's something to this that ladies, and remember, I always tread lightly when it comes to assuming what you ladies are thinking or like, but my experience is that you like receiving compliments, and it's not all bad to give some of the same compliments. Now, when it becomes monotonous, you always say the same thing. So guys, we always say the same thing over and over and over again. Notice that in poetry, there's always variation. You've got themes, but there's always variation. And so even the way that this is written here, we recognize some of the language, but then there's variation. But ladies, do you get tired of hearing compliments? Do you ever go, okay, that's enough? Oh, you've said that to me before. Hopefully we don't get to that point, but that's what he's doing here. So I'm giving you these compliments again, and she's receiving them. So here's, we've said this before the last couple of weeks, but I think it's, I want to reiterate this one more time because I think it's so important. We said in the very, very first week, we were talking about this from the women's perspective, that ladies, you have such a power in your voice. You have such power in the words that you speak to us as your husbands. And I don't think you always understand that. I think it's easy to underestimate just how powerful your words can be. Well, in the same way here, guys, we have to recognize that we have an incredible power to encourage and to compliment our wives. And they need to hear that. We live in a society where comparison is bred, right? It is all around us. There are so many pictures of what women should look like and what women need to look like if they're to be desirable or to be attractive. And so, guys, it is incumbent upon us, like it is a responsibility, it's a privilege for us to say to our wives, you are the one that I want and no other. And let me tell you how beautiful you are. And I said this before, your wife is your standard of beauty and no one else compares because she is your standard of beauty. There is no other comparison. Now, the trick here is that ladies, you have to believe us. You have to believe us when we say, no, really, you are a standard of beauty. And I get it. Sometimes that's really hard to believe. Sometimes we're giving you compliments and you're like, are you crazy right now? Because you just rolled out of bed and your hair's a mess and you haven't brushed your teeth and you're wearing PJs that are inside out because you were so tired you just fell into bed. And he's going, babe, you're hot. And you're like, what are you smoking, right? You don't believe us. But listen, don't argue with us. Don't be like, no, I'm not. My hair's awful. Listen, work it, all right? This is your moment. This is your moment. I can't explain why we find you attractive in the most weird times, okay? But just go with it and remind your husband why he finds you so dang attractive. Like, relish in that, okay? Don't argue with him. Don't tell him he's wrong. Say, mm-hmm, yes, I am. Yes, I am. You got it, buddy. Hey, guys, we've got to, this is, going back to before, this is what we have to be. We have to be gratuitous in our language of praise. We have to go above and beyond. And guys, this is not always easy for us. We tend to, one, be real quiet. Most guys, I don't know, we're just not great at like handing out compliments all the time. But we need to work at this. This needs to be something that we can grow in, to learn how to compliment your wife in a way that she hears you, how to tell your wife that she is beautiful in a way that she believes you. And some of this, guys, is that we need to, let's just be honest for a moment here. Again, we said before, familiarity can breed contempt, or at least indifference. We get used to seeing our wives. And ladies, don't be offended by this. I mean, think about it this way. If you were working at an art museum, let's say you were in Paris working at the Louvre, and you were there every single day, then you might see a painting like this, and over time, you would no longer be amazed. Now, if you go to Paris just to visit, you walk in, and you will spend an exorbitant amount of time. If you've ever been there, you see the crowds packed around to see this beautiful work of art. People are captivated by it, mesmerized by it, and that's how we all used to be with each other. Okay, so ladies, don't be offended, because if you saw this every single day, even you would start to be like, yeah, I've seen it. Or maybe you see this one. This is one of my favorites. Van Gogh, Starry, Starry Night. Over time, you see it. Okay, I get used to it. Here's one of my all-time favorite paintings. Carrie and I have a copy of this in our living room, actually. This is Paris Day, Rainy Street by I just forgot his name, Gustave Caillebotte. And so you would see even these paintings, and you would take them for granted. But don't judge your husbands too harshly by this. But guys, can I tell you a little secret? If you will go out of your way to compliment your wife, and you go out of your way to tell her how beautiful she is, you will find and discover or rediscover just how beautiful she is. If you go out of your way and say, I am going to compliment my wife, I'm going to tell her how beautiful she is, and you find something that you find so attractive about her, and you write it down, and you text it to her, not the flock of goats, or you just tell her, and you're faithful, like you just do this, you will see her differently. You will find yourself noticing her all over again. And she's never changed. She's still there. Right? It's not like she wasn't there and suddenly she's there. This is how we train our hearts. It's how we recapture that magic of saying, oh yeah, I'd almost forgotten, and I don't ever want to forget just how beautiful you are, just how amazing you are. To see your wife is the gift of God that she is in your life. Okay? Your wife wants to know that you want her, body and soul. She needs to know that, because she knows that you're constantly bombarded with pictures of other women. And I'm not, this isn't because you're doing something wrong or that, you shouldn't work with women or anything like that. It's just the reality. And women, you feel this comparison all the time. I mean, think about how exposed we are through how many channels there are on TV or the limitlessness of the internet. There's so many pictures that even if you're trying to avoid it, doesn't matter. You're going to see whatever the society says is the standard beauty. And your wives know that. And so you have to come back and say, no, I want to be real clear. You're the one that I want. You are beautiful. Let me tell you the ways. And that's what this poem is really getting at. As we go along, you're going to see it a little bit more clearly. Now, let me just say real quick, this next part is going to get weird. Okay?
Weirder
just
than the flock of goats?
Oh, yeah. This is where it's going to get weird, okay? So just bear with me. But here's the theme, right? The theme is, I want you and no one else. You are my one and only. But remember, this is a different time. 60 queens there may be and 80 concubines and virgins beyond number, but my dove, my perfect one, is unique. The only daughter of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her, the maiden saw her and called her blessed. The queens and concubines praised her. Now, historically, the Song of Songs have been recognized, not that it was necessarily all written by Solomon, but it was perhaps written somewhat by Solomon, some for Solomon, and that Solomon was the one who pulled all of these songs together, okay, to create this anthology. So when you read something like this, it's very traditional, and it makes sense to read this in light of who Solomon was. So here is the king of Israel, and according to scripture, he had 300 wives and 700 concubines, okay? So when he writes this, in this really strange way, he's trying to compliment her. This is very outside of our context, thankfully, okay? So what he's saying is, look, 60 queens, 80 concubines, virgins beyond number, but you are the one. So queens were kings in the ancient Near East. They were expected to marry queens. Okay? And that doesn't mean a queen from their own hometown who like wasn't a queen and then became a queen, but it was instead that they would go and they would find queens of other nations and they would marry them. And this was a political necessity. And so it was expected by the people of a nation for their king to marry queens of other nations, princesses who maybe became kings or queens. But in other words, this is a political move. This is how you establish safety for your nation. It's how you create stability. And so this was not an unusual practice. Polygamy was expected of kings. This was not God's intention, even for the king of Israel. We don't believe that. But this was part of the culture of their day. Now, the concubines, there's really no excuse for. So we can try to let Solomon off the hook a little bit and be like, well, look, it was a product of his time and he had to do this. Concubines, there's no advantage to having concubines except one in his mind, okay? And the virgins mean that they're in the harem, but they're not concubines yet. So you can figure that one out, okay? So here's my point. This is really messed up. This is really messed up. But it's maybe not as far off from our day as we think it is. Imagine being one of the queens. Now, there's evidence in the ancient Near East that there would be one queen who is sort of valued above all the rest within a relationship. So a king would have his many queens who are political alliances, but then there'd be one queen who is sort of like his true wife, if you will. But imagine this for a second. Imagine for a moment that this is the best praise he can give you. Oh, baby, all those other women that I've been with, you're my favorite.
For now.
Yeah, till I marry another one. Evidently, this was early in Solomon's career, right? We're only at 60 and 80 at the moment, right? So where did she stack up later? So this is our society today. Solomon had, and it's incredible to imagine that as being praise, but what he was experiencing was not the normal experience of the ancient Near East. And this wasn't the normal experience for anyone at any time in human civilization, especially within the nation of Israel. Polygamy has sprouted up in different countries, if you look across all of human civilization, but usually in very isolated areas and for very short amount of times. There's a reason for that. It's a terrible, terrible idea. In Solomon's context, he was the only one who was expected to have this type of relationship with other women. And so for every other person, their experience was one person that they would spend their whole lives with. But that's not true of today. In our society, sex is seen as a commodity. It's a good to be enjoyed. It's even purchased. And so long as everybody consents, then people are treated as sexual objects. Which means that a person's value is increasingly determined by their level of attractiveness. You are valued by how attractive you are as compared to everyone else in society or compared to the standard of beauty that's been set. So this is why dating apps like Tinder became really popular, because you could look at Tinder and you see a picture of a person, and in that moment you make a judgment call whether they're attractive enough for you to invest your time with. Do I want to date with this person? Swipe right. Nope, too ugly. Swipe left. And so people were reduced to sexual objects, simply a picture of who they are. And thankfully, Tinder is actually way on the decrease. People use it far less because finally, even we, as dense as we are, realize that it was dehumanizing and lazy. but it's a comparative game, right? It's a comparison game. It is you ranking everybody else according to whatever that imaginary standard of beauty is that society has set. And it's successful because we live in a society that breeds comparison. Why? Because comparison drives profit. Comparison drives consumption. So keeping up with the Joneses has been around for a really long time. And we've been talking about this for decades. Keeping up with the Joneses, what are you going to get? Well, we live in a time now where we can consume everything. We can compare everything, and then we can buy something to make it better. And we can do that with our cars and our houses. We can do that with our look. We can do that with our physical appearance. We can do that with our clothes. We can do that with our kids, the activities they have. We can do that with our experiences. We can do that with our churches and our pastors. We can do that with anything. And the idea that this consumerism that has so run rampant, I mean, we live in the most consumeristic society that the world has ever seen. And that's not hyperbolic. That's not even debatable. That's reality. But the idea that this consumerism and comparison that drive each other, they feed off of each other, that runs so rampant, then stays outside of our marriages, somehow our marriages are immune to that, is naive. And so pornography is just the most obvious example of this. It's just the most obvious. Because pornography is lust commercialized, right? So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because here's what I believe. I don't believe that I have to convince any of you that pornography is a bad idea. Okay? I'm going to give you just a couple of little things just to kind of drive it home a little bit. But I don't think that I need to spend a ton of time here like parsing this out for you. Pornography is a bad idea. And it's not just with men. Statistically, women's addiction to porn is on the rise and has been for a really long time. According to a recent study, women actually watch more porn than men do. I know that sounds crazy, but if you look at the amount of time that women actually spend watching pornography, it's actually more than men. And according to a 2016 study, 76% of women between the ages of 18 and 30 watch porn. After you get over 30, it goes down to about 68%. After you get over 40, it goes down to about 55%, and it kind of decreases from there. But those are still very high numbers. And so we have this stigma of like, well, this is a men's thing. It's not. It's not. It's both. It's both genders. And so for both men and women, pornography becomes an escape. It's a fantasy. Right? And so it's often when you feel tired, it's when you feel depressed, when you feel stressed, when things aren't good between you and your spouse, it's when the kids are really exhausting and you just need a break. That's like any other drug, and it becomes an addiction. And most drugs we still frown upon, but obviously we're starting to accept more and more drugs. And pornography, though, as a drug, understand, is perfectly accepted within society. I read a lot online stuff, and it's amazing the articles that I'll read. They're just, you know, popular blogs, how casually they'll talk about watching porn or someone they know watching porn. And it's just in the context of, you know, that's what they were doing on a Saturday night. It's just become commonplace. It's just another appetite, a craving to be satisfied, right? And this is one of the ways that we can do it, because it's not about a relationship, it's about pleasure. And pleasure is what it's really all about. A couple other things. Pornography literally kills love. And by that I mean that your marriage will not withstand pornography. I'll cut to the chase here. If you want to have a really bad marriage, if you want your sex life to suck, if you want to have a bad self-image, if you want your spouse to have a bad self-image, if you want to have more anxiety and depression, then do that. That's the way to do it. And that's not me making stuff up. That's based on studies that people have done, not within the Christian world. This is within the church, like, oh, we have to prove something to Christians because they hate pornography. This is just mainstream. Everybody acknowledges this. You don't get around the numbers. You're twice as likely to have a divorce. It is very, very bad, okay? Now, we often focus on how bad it is for the person who's watching, but I do want to give you just a little bit, because this is, I think, probably the even bigger, at least in my mind, devastation of this is what it does to your spouse, because no one can compete with porn. And so we think of this as like this victimless crime. So I'm going to watch pornography and that shouldn't bother my spouse or hurt my spouse. But understand that it is absolutely devastating to a spouse. And one of the reasons for that is because, again, it's a drug. And like any other drug, for it to continue to have that high that you're after, you have to have stronger and stronger and more and more. And so, again, statistically, studies have shown, and I know the stories of men and women who no longer can be sexually aroused by their partner because they are so deep into porn. Let me read you, this is a letter. This is a letter from a woman. It was not to me. This is off a site called Fight the New Drug. It's a site dedicated, it's not a Christian site, but it's dedicated to fighting pornography. A lot of really helpful resources there, but I found this letter on there. And it's just, it's horrible. So I'm going to read it to you just because I can't get it out of my mind. So this is what she says. As the partner of a porn addict, listen to this. As a partner of a porn addict, I've watched this epidemic destroy our relationship as well as my self-worth. I have zero self-esteem anymore. My partner used to say that his habit, quote, didn't hurt anyone, and, quote, didn't change anything in our relationship. But now he can't even get aroused with me. He can only get aroused with porn. The material he consumes is increasingly more extreme. I cannot, listen to the language, I cannot compete with the porn stars he prefers over me. These women seemingly have no limitations to what they will do. I've tried everything, and I'll skip some of this. He doesn't even turn his head to look when I'm naked. And when I try to get him going, he no longer can get turned on, and goes on from there. Day after day, he makes zero attempt to initiate sex and even calls it a chore now, saying porn is relaxing and less work. See, it's all about pleasure. 5 years ago, we had a passionate, happy, loving relationship. Today, we're just two strangers in the same house. You cannot compete with porn. And it doesn't matter what you tell your spouse, right? This is Solomon all over again. Honey, I've got all these other queens and concubines, but you're my favorite. You think she's buying this? And it's the other way too. Ladies, you can tell your husband, that again, studies have been shown for guys as well as for women. If his spouse is watching porn, his self-esteem suffers. He cannot compete with porn. And no one can satisfy lust. And remember, porn is lust commercialized. Okay, so sex within the context of marriage is this beautiful thing that God has built into us. It's to bring him glory, which is this crazy idea. And the fact that this book is even in the Bible. But God didn't go, ooh, when he created sex. He said, this is beautiful. This is good. But this is what sin does. It takes something that is good and beautiful that God creates, and then it twists it and it perverts it and it drives it to an extreme and makes it an addiction and an idol. And that's what lust is. It's when that sexual desire has been so stretched that it's distorted and no longer what God intended. C.S. Lewis has a great illustration that he offers using food as an example. He says, imagine that you're sitting there and you're eating this amazing steak. I was at lunch with Doug Ekstrom. Where's Doug's in here somewhere. Or he was. He left. This lesson's going really well. People are leaving halfway through. He went to do communion. Okay, see, it wasn't me. Had sushi with Doug this week. Love sushi. Okay, it is the candy of the sea. Praise God for little dead fishes. Okay, I love sushi. Okay, so I'm sitting there and I'm like, man, I can eat this sushi. And it just, man, I want to burst into praise of God who was so creative in giving us fish and then giving people the creativity to not even cook them, just prepare them beautifully. A little soy sauce, right? Okay, so maybe you're not a sushi person, but C.S. Lewis says, imagine eating the steak. And you eat the steak and it's great and it's wonderful. He said, but imagine that you find yourself in a society where you walk into a room and there's a stage and there's a curtain and they pull it back and there's a steak that no one gets to enjoy, but everyone does. And it's covered up. And they begin to slowly unveil the steak. And people are drooling and cheering. And he says, you would think you found yourself in one messed up society. See, Steak is a good thing. It is a gift of God. We get to enjoy it and enjoy it, and it's wonderful. If you're a vegetarian, I'm sorry. I'm offending you right now. Imagine that carrot that's just so, so good, perfectly sautéed. Okay. But sin takes something that's beautiful and it makes it unquenchable. Lust, by its very nature, you cannot satisfy it. You cannot quench it. It always wants more, always wants more, always wants more. It is the sexual appetite gone horribly wrong. Now, I've said all of that, and I got to end here, though, okay? Because this is where the church has got this wrong. In our language and the way that we talk about it, pornography is not the ultimate sin. It is not the unforgivable sin. And what happens within the church is we talk about it so strongly, okay, that we heap shame upon people who struggle with this. And the point of grace is not shame. The point of the gospel is not shame. It is a liberation from shame. And so what happens within the church is we talk about pornography and suddenly becomes, man, don't ever admit to this. Let's drive it underground. But I'm telling you, that is the opposite of what we need to be doing. Because sin thrives in the darkness. And instead, what we need to do is to bring to light and say, this is sin. Yeah, it is. And we repent, but we are sinners saved by grace. Every single one of us. There's not one person in this room who goes, well, you've got that sin, but I don't have any. Just pick your sin, man. Okay? So let me just say, like, if you are a man or a woman here, and you look at porn, maybe you're addicted, maybe you're not. Maybe it's just something you do every once in a while, but you need to stop, and you know you need to stop. So a couple of things need to happen. One is you need to confess this to your spouse. Talk about vulnerable and scary, do it. And here's the thing. Again, in this vein, spouses, if your spouse comes to you and says this, do not shame them. I know this sounds crazy, and you can be hurt, and you don't have to sit there and go, oh, I forgive you. It's all fine. I'm not saying that. But recognize the courage that it took for your spouse to come and to tell you that, and the fact that they clearly are trying to honor you in that. They don't want to do this, okay? And extend grace, okay? But if you are the one watching, go and tell your spouse. And then if you can just cut it off, great. But if you can't, because this is a drug in your life, then you need to get help. You need to get help. And I know there can be a stigma attached to that, but can I tell you something? You won't find it in this church. You won't find that stigma in this church. Now, there might be an individual or two, and I will have a chat with them if you'd like, okay? I'm not even kidding, okay? Regen is going on right now. This is a program developed at Watermark. We have it here. Roger Pryor leads it. I see a number of faces in here of people who've been through the program, and it is life-changing. And you go in there, and there is not shame. There is encouragement. There is acceptance, but not complacency, not resignation. It's a place for you to grow, and it's founded on the gospel. And you come together, and you say, yeah, we're all sinners, and we are walking through this together. And you're going to find people, and it's going to be all kinds of issues. It's not just pornography. It's all different things. And yet, everybody's in the same boat. Okay, so if this is you, you need to get help, okay? But it's not the ultimate sin. Do not hear me saying you are a worse sinner than anyone else. You are not. You are not. Okay. Okay. Now we got to, dang, all right. We're really, so having all said all that, this is why we're going to have to blaze through some of this here, okay? Here's his point, though. As messed up as this is, his point is this. You are the one that I want. No one else. Right? You can't tell your spouse that if you're addicted to porn. So get help. You are the only one I want. There's no one else. That's what he's saying. And this is what he keeps saying. Who is this that appears like the dawn, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, majestic as the stars in procession? This word majestic has the sense of unnerving beauty. It's like weak in the knees kind of beauty. I see you and I can hardly like stand up. He melts in her presence. And what is he saying? He says, man, compared to every other light that there is, they all pale in comparison. You are the brightest light. Everyone else, man, I don't even notice. They're like a silhouette compared to you. You are brightness. He says, I went down to the grove of nut trees to look at the new growth in the valley to see if the vines had budded or the pomegranates were in bloom. What's he saying? It's a picture of going to see if now's the right time. There's something to this, guys. We tend to compartmentalize. So if Carrie in any moment says, I have something on my mind, I'll be like, uh-huh. It doesn't matter what's going on at work. It doesn't matter how distracted I am. I'm like ready to shift gears, okay? Just being real, real honest here, okay? Guys, our wives are not like that. I don't know if you've noticed. So if you come home and somewhere along the line you were driving home and you start thinking about how much you'd like to spend time with your wife, if you know what I mean? And then you walk in and you're like, babe, have I got a plan for you? And she's just come home as well from work and her boss is giving her a hard time and things aren't going well with a client, or she's been at home up to her neck in diapers and she's like, where have you been? And you're like, babe, I've been thinking about you. She's like, yeah, I've been thinking about you too. Okay? So let's be sensitive here. That's what this is saying. He says, I'm going to go down and I'm going to see. I'm going to kind of test the waters here. Is now a good time? Maybe I should think about timing here just a little bit. Let's be sensitive to this. How do you make it where there is a right time, okay? All right, we got to keep moving. All right, we have no idea what this means. Before I realized it, my desire set me among the royal chariots of my people. No one has any clue what this means. I'm not kidding. If you read the commentaries, they use words like, you know, baffling, clueless. I mean, no one has any idea. So what the NET Bible does, which is one translation, they use what's called an emendation. And so they re-vocalize some things and change a couple of letters. And they get this. I was beside myself with joy. There, please give me your myrrh, O daughter of my princely people. And what he's saying is, I want to be with you. I want to spend time with you. I want your scent to just envelop me. Okay. There's a good reason for why they did this. They're very smart people, okay? They didn't just do it on a whim. But no, we actually, otherwise we had no idea what they're saying. Okay, come back, O Shulamite. Remember, this is the word that he uses describing his love, O Shulamite. Come back, that we may gaze on you. Why would you gaze on the Shulamite as on the dance of Mahanim, something like that. So the words here, come back, actually have a probably better translated. I think there's a good argument to be made as turn, turn. And so what he's describing here, and this fits really well with the rest of the song as we keep going, is it's a dance. It's a wedding dance. And so she's twirling in front of everyone. So this is in that, this is the first dance of the wedding, right? After the ceremony, and she stands out in front of everyone, and he's saying, turn, turn. Let everyone gaze upon your beauty. Turn, turn. And then he says, he begins to praise her. And he starts with her feet. Why? Because she's spinning. And he sees her feet spinning. And now he's going to praise her from foot up. We tend to think from head to toe. This is from toe to head. How beautiful your sandaled feet, O prince's daughter. Your graceful legs are like jewels, the work of a craftsman's hands. This is, again, language. It's going to get a little weird here. Your navel is a rounded goblet that never lacks blended wine. Your waist is a mound of wheat encircled by lilies. Your breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Okay. The navel is a rounded goblet that never lacks blended wine. It's describing a goblet that was actually used to pour stronger wine into weaker wine in order to make it more potent. So they would mix it. So it wasn't to dilute the wine. It was actually the opposite. And so what he's describing here is this mid part of you is intoxicating to me. He's saying, your love is intoxicating. I want to be drunk on your love, essentially. I can never get enough of it. And then your waist is a mound of wheat encircled by lilies. Again, very odd. But what he's essentially saying is, you are my drink and my food. I want to enjoy you. I want to be intoxicated by you. I want to be filled up with you. I just want you. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are the pools of Heshbon by the gate of Bath Rabbim. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon looking toward Damascus. Evidently, they liked more prominent noses. That was probably more of a staple of their standard of beauty. Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel. Your hair is like royal tapestry. The king is held captive by its tresses. How beautiful you are and how pleasing, O love, with your delights. The language here is suggesting that everything that he's just described is his delight. And so it's, you've heard life is like a box of chocolates. Husbands, Your wives are like boxes of chocolates. You delight in every one. Every piece is to your delight. That's what he's just saying. I delight in every single piece of you. Your stature is like that of the palm, and your breasts like clusters of fruit. And I said, I will climb the palm tree. I will take hold of its fruit. So there were two reasons to climb a palm tree in the ancient. There were two reasons. One is to get the fruit down because it actually didn't fall. Okay? So you had to get the fruit down. Second reason was palm trees, you have female fruit and male fruit. And so if you wanted to speed up the process of fruit on a female fruit plant, you actually had to take the pollen from the male fruit over here and you climb up, get it, climb back down, climb back up over here, and you would inseminate the female fruit of this other palm tree. How bizarre is that? So what's he saying? I want to climb you. Okay. May your breasts be like the clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples. This is actually probably better apricots. I don't know if you've noticed, apples don't smell like a whole lot, but they think it's more apricots. That was known for its sweet smell. And your mouth like the best wine. May the wine go straight to my lover, flowing gently over lips and teeth. Again, love is intoxicating. I belong to my lover, and his desire is for me. We are out of time, so I'm gonna have to stop here. But this is the theme. Let me close with this. Commitment is not drudgery. So we started this whole series. We were like, we're not talking about commitment. It's assumed. It's implied. It is. But what we start to get the picture, the more you read through the songs, is this: that while the world thinks that passion and romance is killed by commitment, what we find is that commitment is the only place that romance and passion and true love actually flourishes. Commitment is not drudgery, it's not boring, it's not archaic, it's not antiquated, it's not old-fashioned, it is exciting, it is terrifying, it is vulnerable, and it is dang sexy. And you think about when you told your spouse for the first time, I love you, and you tell them along the way in your marriage when you made your vows in your wedding day, and then after that, whenever you stop and you gaze into each other's eyes and that stare is so intense that it threatens to overwhelm you, and you say to the other person, I want you and you alone, and they say it back to you, that's intense. That's intense. That is intoxicating. So, does your spouse know you love them that way? See, this is an invitation, right? To speak like this to your spouse. Whatever language that they're going to understand it. How do you speak to them in such a way that you say, I want you and you alone, and they believe you, and you say it to one another? That's intense. It's intense. Why don't you try it this week? And I'll see you next week. Lord, we thank you for this time. Thank you for your word. We ask that you bless the worship service, if that's where we're going. And Lord, if not, people are headed home. I just pray that this would be a week in which we're honoring to you in our lives and our work, but Lord, especially in our marriages. We just recognize that marriage is an incredible gift that you've given to us, and it looks like Jesus and the church when we do it well. So help us to do it well. Help us to love one another in a way that's honoring to you. And we pray this in Christ's name. Amen. Amen.